Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my lovely betwixters. It's me, Kate Lister. You are here once again, and I'm so thrilled that you are. But before we can keep going, I think you know what's coming your way. That's right, it is the Fair Dues Warning. This is an adult podcast spoken by adults to other adults about adulty things in an adulty way, covering a range of adult subjects, and you should be an adult too. And for all of the adults out there, just while you're here, if you could possibly just take a couple of seconds to please subscribe and follow along wherever it is that you get your podcasts. I know it's a tired line, but the absolute truth of it is that Dan Snow keeps us all in a cellar. And unless we get more subscriptions, he's not going to let us out. Please, Betwixtons, we need your help. Right, on with the show. It's the year 1098, and we are on the rugged isles of Anglesey in Wales. Land of St. David, daffodils, leeks, Tom Jones, and of course, the Vikings? Yeah, they got there too. It's winter, and you've guessed it, the weather isn't great. There are hundreds of wooden longships pulled up all along the shore, and one man is pacing up and down the beach. Despite the weather, he's got his legs out. He's wearing something kind of similar to a kilt. This man, betwixters, is the King of Norway, Magnus Barelegs. And apparently he got his nickname because he was very fond of short tunics. Who isn't? And he's just taken control of the island after killing his Norman opponent with an arrow to the eye. And Anglesey is now officially classed as the southern border of Norway. A Norwegian bare-legged king in a kilt on an island in Wales without a horned helmet is perhaps not the stereotypical image of a Viking. But it is a true story. So today we are going to be busting a few more Viking myths and find out how the Victorians rewrote our understanding of that period, as well as learning more about the lives of Viking royalty.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what a beautiful time. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Hello and welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal and society with me, Kate Lister. If you have a smartphone, it's likely that you have encountered Viking royalty in the form of Bluetooth. Yep, Harald Bluetooth was the king of Denmark and Norway, and he apparently got his name because of his rotten teeth. And as you heard in the intro, the Vikings really liked a nickname for their kings. As well as Barelegs and Bluetooth, we have got Forkbeard and Ivar the Boneless. And what else do we know about these leaders? Who were the royal Viking women? And why did the Victorians mess up our understanding of the Vikings so spectacularly? Today, I am joined by historian Caitlin Ellis to find out more about Viking royalty. Longboats at the ready. Let's do it. Hello, and welcome to Betwixt the Sheets. It's only Caitlin Ellis. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. It's a sunny day here in Oslo, so can't complain.
Is it? Lovely. And you are Associate Professor in Medieval Nordic History at the University mm-hmm. of Oslo. So if there's anyone we need to be talking to about the Vikings, it is you. Can I ask, what brought you to this study? Do you remember that there was a point when you went, oh, the Vikings, they're the very people for me. I want to study them.
Yeah, good question. Yeah, I think when I was little, I think actually maybe at first I was intrigued by sort of all the mythology and the stories, like the legends. You know, you maybe get like children's retellings of them. And then as I got a bit older, maybe I kind of read the original thing. Obviously in translation, you know, you get all the penguin translations of things. And there's some good sort of historical literature. And yeah, I suppose I just maybe the medieval period appealed a bit because it's a bit unknown. And I think we didn't really do so much of that in school, maybe when I was in primary school and high school, you know, it was a bit more, maybe you did the Romans and then you kind of skipped to like the 20th century and there was sort of this gap in between.
That's true.
I mean, it might be different nowadays, people in school, but yeah, you sort of wondered what happened in between. So yeah, in some ways it's kind of mysterious, but in some ways we have all these kind of sources that are out there and that are really interesting to engage with. Yeah.
Do you think that, so the reason that we get taught about the Romans, we know loads about the Romans, and like, you know, there's a Roman Empire, men think about it every single day, apparently, is because they left so much evidence and writing and statues and infrastructure and architecture, and blah, 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 blah. Did the Vikings leave as much that we've got to work with? Is that one of the reasons why perhaps there's a bit of sort of darkness around this particular period in history?
Yeah, maybe. And I suppose maybe the sort of classical world used to be seen as kind of, this is where all the good things happen, right? Or civilization begins or something. And we will like hark back to it. And as you say, this idea of the Dark Ages, I guess, particularly for the early medieval period, as if, yeah, after the Romans, it all just sort of disintegrated and everything was terrible and dark and horrible. And, you know, but yeah, we maybe do have a little bit of a problem about a lack of sources for some areas. But yeah, definitely not as stark, I guess, as that stereotype would imply. Mm. And we do have, yeah, amazing artifacts and kind of works of artistry. And yeah, maybe not so many like huge stone buildings and amphitheatres and kind of things like that. But I suppose, yeah, in the northern world in particular, if things are being built out of wood and so on, obviously that's less likely to survive in the longer term. But yeah, I suppose now Vikings seem to be on trend almost, you know, they're in a lot of popular culture, which is good for me in that students take the modules. So
is it good for you as an academic who really studies the history of the Vikings, or do you find yourself getting very grumpy about the mythology of the Vikings? Do you find yourself kind of like running after it, going, no, they didn't have horns on their helmets and they didn't do this and they didn't do that? Or are you quite happy to let this myth play out?
Yeah, a bit of both, I think. Yeah, like in some ways, you know, I think we should just be pleased if anyone takes an interest in something that I'm interested in and that I study. If we can get people interested in the medieval period in the first place, that's sort of maybe part of the battle. But then, yeah, I suppose there are some stereotypes, obviously, and maybe that can be frustrating if you sort of keep hearing the same thing, or someone just sort of found some dodgy source on the internet and then kind of thinks that they're an expert. And I suppose there is also maybe the slightly dangerous aspect. Some of the stereotypes has obviously been connections to kind of white supremacy and neo-Nazism. So that bit, I guess, is the thing that we'd be most uncomfortable with, the way that things can be kind of misappropriated and misused, taken out of their context and used in a very different, potentially kind of dangerous way. But yeah, hopefully lots of students are willing to learn, and sort of sometimes maybe it can be fun to kind of challenge the stereotypes a bit and sort of nuance the like TV or film image that they have, maybe.
So if we start with a real basic page one question, what is your categorization of a Viking? Like, what does somebody have to do? When do they have to have lived? Where do they have to have lived for you to comfortably say you're a Viking?
Yeah, that's something that scholars still argue about to this day. So I guess the original meaning of the word, like in Old Norse, vikingr is the noun for a person, or viking is the sort of the activity, like to go raiding, to go a Viking, as it were. So yeah, I guess it is kind of just being used as a job description, you know, rather than a cultural identity or an ethnic identity. So literally it meant a pirate, a raider, someone who goes plundering. That's the original meaning of the word, but obviously it's come to be used for sort of the whole society of medieval Scandinavia and the Scandinavians who go out and leave and go and raid and settle and trade across sort of most of Europe and even beyond. So yeah, something that we still sort of slightly argue about how we should use the term precisely. So maybe we should only be using Viking for the people who are doing the raiding. But I suppose we still maybe talk about the Viking age and the Viking world and things like that. So we could maybe just try and call them medieval Scandinavians, but then it's also possible that some of the people who are raiding with them are not actually originally Scandinavian, right? Mm. They could have been from all of these places that they travel. I mean, I suppose it's like anything that all of our terms are always, you know, somewhat imperfect, you know, or our periodizations or whatever it might be. So yeah, the traditional chronology, I suppose, would be from the sort of 8th century to the 11th century, that would be the Viking age, with maybe slight differences almost depending on which country you look at, right? So if we're in England, we maybe like to think that the end of the Viking Age is 1066, because, you know, the Norwegian king Harald Hardrada dies and then we get the Norman conquest. So we kind of think this is the start of a new era. But, you know, if we're looking at other parts of Europe, that date isn't necessarily quite so significant. And I suppose I am a little bit more interested in this sort of later Viking age, or kind of after that date as well, when there's still Scandinavian kings who are kind of coming in on big naval expeditions to Britain and Ireland. So it's not necessarily so clear cut. Well, some people have tried to talk about there being like two Viking ages. Peter Sawyer had this idea that actually, if we're thinking about those very early Viking raids, it's such a different scale to these big invasion attempts in the 11th century. So then we'd end up dividing it even more.
I can understand why it's just easier to go Viking. It was just, they're all Viking.
Yeah. It's definitely convenient, yeah.
Once you start trying to get the real nuance in there, it becomes very, very confusing. But we are talking about Viking royalty today. And I'm kind of interested in, because obviously these are a group of people that, would we say it's feudalism, that they use their system of like the king at the top, the plebs at the bottom, and they're using enslaved people? What sort of system of government did these people have?
I suppose we normally associate feudalism maybe with a bit later in the medieval period, or we feel that Scandinavia maybe doesn't have such a developed system of government if we were comparing it to England or to Francia at the same time. So we don't really have such a thing as Norway or Denmark quite yet for a lot of this period, or we're kind of starting to, or sort of aspirationally is there that people are starting to try and say, I'm the most important king, but there are still some other kings knocking around. We sort of end up talking about petty kings, like sort of smaller scale kings. But yeah, I think it still would have been a hierarchical society. I guess sometimes we can have a slightly romantic notion that, like, yeah, everyone was equal, just because it was a bit less hierarchical or not so much of a kind of aristocracy maybe as in other places. But yeah, as you say, there's still slaves, you know, they are being traded and plundered just as much as kind of precious metal in this period as sort of part of Viking activity. So that's obviously the more unpleasant side that I guess we need to not forget, although obviously it doesn't go with that nice romantic image of the Vikings, as we say, that we see in the media sometimes.
When you've got kings, and hopefully queens, hopefully we can talk about some queens as well, what kind of areas are they ruling over? I've never ever heard of petty Viking kings before, and I love that concept that there was a king, but he was kind of a rubbish king, so we're not going to count him properly. I'm trying to get an understanding of,
yeah, I suppose petty kings makes it sound a bit like he's just kind of really petulant and gets annoyed easily or something, but
doesn't let people play in his longboat. So is it that people are kings and rulers over small areas if countries aren't forming yet? Is this sort of like almost, I don't want to say tribal like the Celts, but is that kind of what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, I think in terms of sort of smaller areas, maybe, yeah, you know, maybe they can then start to beat the neighbouring king, yeah, and then you can start to kind of consolidate power and kind of gradually build up into something that looks more like the nations that we kind of recognise today. But I suppose it's also maybe that we've not got a system of like primogeniture, you know, of the succession isn't so established as we'd get sort of in the later period, you know, that I'm the eldest son of this guy, so therefore I get to be king after him. We maybe have a system based on kind of who's a good candidate, like who's powerful, who has support from particularly the army or the kind of warrior bands and sort of retinues. So maybe it has to be someone in the family of the previous king, but then that could obviously still leave you with quite a few claimants who might try and kind of try and come in and sort of take over. So there's maybe a bit of kind of instability that situation would create. And I suppose that has been one of the arguments for why did they go raiding at all, is that you need to kind of maintain your position by going and getting lots of wealth that you can reward all your followers with. But then I guess that becomes a bit of a kind of vicious a cycle, right? That then you have to have all these followers and this warband to maintain your position, and you have to keep them happy, so you have to keep going raiding, and then you need the warband.
Yes. And say what you want about Viking kings, is they did have some belting names, didn't they? Like there was someone, I don't know if he was a king, but there was someone Hairy Britches and mm-hmm. someone Bluetooth, but there was a king Bearleg.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you go about getting that particular name? Who was King Bearleg?
Yeah, so his first name is Magnus, but yeah, as you say, this is the sort of colourful nickname epithet that he gets known by, Bearlegs or sort of Bearfotter in Old Norse, sort of bare feet. So yeah, bear is in naked, not as in very hairy or something. So the sagas actually have like a couple of slightly different explanations for where that name comes from. So one of them sort of has it that he gets kind of attacked, sort of, you know, he's taken a bit by surprise, unawares, so he has to kind of like rush out of the tent, and he's not really had time to put his trousers on yet because there's no time to delay. And then one of the other sources says that it's because he sort of spent time in like Britain and Ireland that he's kind of adopted some sort of kind of tunic thing. I mean, it sort of puts you in mind of a kilt, although a kilt is sort of a much later thing, really, as if he's just sort of adopted a new kind of style of dress. But yeah, those sources are a little bit later than he lives, so it's a bit difficult to know for sure. Whereas, yes, some of the others are a bit more straightforward. If someone's called the Tall, then that's a bit easier to get a sense of what that means, right?
But it's bonkers to think that like some of them might just be that it's like a nickname of something that happened that you did that was really embarrassing, and now forevermore you are going to be officially known. It's such a strange system.
Yeah, and I guess this is a society where like reputation is really important, potentially, you know, like your standing in society is sort of maybe based on some of, yeah, what people think of you and these stories. So I suppose, yeah, if you had a particularly unflattering nickname, that could be a bit of a problem, if you become the butt of the joke.
That would be. So what kind of king was King Bearleg? What was it? Was he a good king? Was he a bad king? What was his origin story?
Yeah, so he is the son of a guy called Olaf Kyrre, which sort of means the quiet or the peaceful. So he wasn't doing much of the Viking stuff, much warfare. The father was a bit more just focused on like making kind of Norway strong and kind of on internal improvements, as it were. Oh. But this Olaf, he had seen his father and be killed at Stamford Bridge. He'd seen Harald Hardrada be killed, so he was with him. So I suppose it's possible to think that, you know, yeah, if you see your father be killed in battle while trying to invade another land, maybe you might decide, I'm just going to stay here in Norway and just like not try and expand my territory and just kind of stick here. This is fine.
Absolutely.
But then it seems like his son, like Magnus, kind of harks back to his grandfather more, sort of takes after him. So he does seem a bit more kind of ambitious and warlike, and sort of has conflicts kind of with other Scandinavian kingdoms as well. But then I guess he's particularly known for having these two expeditions to Britain and Ireland. And we are now more sort of at the end of the 11th century and into the very, very beginning of the 12th. So I say some people would say it isn't really Viking anymore, technically, but I say this is almost the period that I'm sort of interested in, as to what are we calling it? Like, are they post-Vikings, or, you know, they're still acting in the same way as a lot of their predecessors, but it's definitely an interesting period.
And they wouldn't have had any conception of like, oh, we're not Vikings anymore, or whatever it was that how they referred to themselves. Would they? Yeah. That wouldn't have occurred to them at the time.
Yeah, suddenly they all woke up and said, right, that's it. There's a new era now.
What I really liked about King Bearlegs was the story that he is the child of his dad and one of his dad's concubines. Is that right?
Yeah, so we don't actually even know for certain who she is. Again, I think some of the sources kind of give different names, sort of come up with different possible identifications for her. So I mean, sometimes that's the problem in medieval history, that the women just don't don't feature as much as we might like or don't get named. But yeah, I suppose it's kind of maybe not so uncommon in this period that the king may well have a wife, but sort of also has other sexual partners as well. Yeah. And it might be that it seems like in this period, it's not necessarily, I suppose maybe concubine now, you sort of think that it might have associations of that, like being looked down upon or kind of being like a slightly negative kind of connotations. It might be a bad thing to be, but we sort of think that actually it might have been somewhat advantageous, well, maybe to the woman herself and to the family. So I guess it is possible that some of these women might have kind of chosen to do this, or I suppose also that their family might have kind of pushed them into doing it, which is, could also be unpleasant. But by that association with the king, obviously if you end up bearing the heir who like becomes king, then obviously that's a particular kind of really good bonus to have as a family that would increase your status.
Absolutely.
But we even get kind of references to things like the king's brother. So actually someone who's not of royal status, you know, or doesn't have any kind of royal blood themselves, but is like the half brother to the king, sort of from his mother's side. So just because he's like been in the same womb that the king has been, he still sort of has some kind of association. So it sort of seems like in the earlier periods, kind of being a concubine or sort of having that connection to royalty isn't necessarily something kind of shameful or anything like that.
No, that doesn't surprise me at all. You see that all the time, the kind of professional mistress, the actual sugar baby of the king, or it seems to be a very coveted position. But you know what it has made me wonder is, has anyone done any research on Viking sex work? I mean, if there's like a system of concubinage of people, you know, like, great, you can shag the king and get pregnant and that's brilliant. That's a way to get lots of money. But what about like further down the social scale? Presumably people were buying and selling sex, but I can't remember reading anything about anyone researching just Viking sex for sale.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I'm not sure I'm aware of anything in that much detail either. I suppose maybe the assumption has been that a lot of that need might almost be being filled by slaves have a choice don't get paid.
Yes.
Or I suppose maybe eventually, I guess if they're pleasing enough, they might get their freedom or something at some point. But yeah, I think you're right. There might have been some sort of expectation that if you have this sort of relationship with a king, that you might get some sort of financial reward. And obviously if you have a child, you would hope that the king would give you something to help with the upkeep of the child and raising them.
I'll be back with Caitlin after this short break.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If somebody excavated a Viking brothel, that would just tell us so much, wouldn't it? That would be my archaeological find of the century. I'm fascinated. But the idea that there was a sort of a system of concubinage of professional mistresses, That's interesting. But what's really interesting as well is that that didn't stop King Barelegs becoming king. Mm-hmm. So like you were saying, illegitimacy doesn't seem to have been as big an issue for the Viking culture.
Yeah, certainly not in this kind of period. I guess there maybe starts to be a bit of a change over time, maybe with the kind of growing influence of Christianity as well, you know, and what the church has to say about things, that you then get more of an emphasis on what is the proper line of succession and that you should be legitimate from a sort of church-approved marriage and everything like that. And I suppose maybe they themselves even start to realise that perhaps that could also be good for stability to an extent as well, that then if you don't have as many people kind of competing for the throne, as many different contenders, it might make things a little bit kind of smoother if everyone kind of agrees that this is the system. But I guess it's maybe a somewhat of a kind of gradual change. And I guess maybe very kind of just dependent on the particular situations. If an illegitimate one is the only option or the best option or is a lot older, and then it's like, are you going to choose a little infant that's legitimate over him? Or so I suppose individuals could maybe try and use it a little bit opportunistically perhaps. But yeah, I think maybe with this growing concern about stability, and maybe as we get a bit later on, you almost wonder if some of these kings are deliberately trying not to do that and stop that happening, trying to sort of like limit the possible number of children that there could be and kind of not have so many concubines and so on. And I suppose particularly because we get this issue that because people like Magnus Barelegs and other kings have spent all this time abroad and presumably had dalliances and affairs and whatnot, concubines there, then you can get someone coming from abroad who suddenly sort of rocks up and says, oh, I'm actually totally the son of so-and-so, but, you know, I'm from like a different culture in a lot of ways. And now you have to kind of take me into account. And that probably creates even more uncertainty and kind of...
Did that happen quite a lot? Just people turning up going, he was definitely my dad, definitely.
Yeah, we do get a fair bit. So actually Magnus himself, we do have someone who turns up in the 1120s, and he's called Harold Gilly or Giller, which seems to be short for Gillachrist. So that's a kind of Gaelic name meaning kind of like the servant of Christ or sort of like devotee of Christ. We often get it paired with kind of saints' names. So yeah, he just sort of is supposedly a result of a relationship that Magnus had in kind of Ireland or the Hebrides. And then, yeah, he kind of turned up. And I think some of the sources even imply that like he doesn't speak Old Norse very well, but they actually make him go through like an ordeal, you know, kind of like the trial by ordeal idea of sort of hot iron. You know, there's like bishops there who are like overseeing this and like seeing whether they think that this is, and he does pass this test apparently. Yeah, I don't know how, but then the king at the time, his sort of half-brother, also makes him swear an oath to say that they can kind of like share rule, but that he shouldn't kind of try and claim the throne as long as he's alive and that his son is alive. But then he doesn't actually really stick to that. So when this king dies, he comes back into things. And it's actually almost the start of the Norwegian Civil War era, which lasts for sort of over 100 years with lots of competing claimants. And yet we get another one, King Sverre, who sort of grew up in the Faroe Islands. And then yeah, suddenly his mother says, oh, actually, he's not the child of my husband. He's the child of the king. And then they have to try and, you know, again, go through various processes to try and prove this. But yeah, I guess scholars are still slightly in disagreement as to whether we should believe the story at all. With Harold, we do also have a poem that Magnus Barelegs supposedly wrote to a woman in Ireland. Or at least people claim that he writes poems, which, yeah, I guess it is quite interesting for us when we think about all these very warlike people. And then there's also some kind of love poetry. I think I have it here, actually.
Oh, please do. I've got to know what a Viking love poem is like.
It says, what's this talk of going home? My heart is in Dublin, and the women of Trondheim won't see me this autumn. The girl has not denied me pleasure visits. I'm glad. I love the Irish lady as well as my young self. So yes, this is attributed to the king in the sagas that we get. Yeah.
He was married, wasn't he? So he's a cheating dog, but that's still quite sweet.
Yes, yeah.
Do we know anything about the woman he was writing it for, the woman in Ireland?
No, yeah, that's kind of the only glimpse that we get, really. I suppose a lot of this poetry, the sort of skaldic poetry, we do get quite a few that are sort of to do with love and sort of romance. Most of it is about war, is about battle and kind of like praising the king. So often it's sort of not written by the kings themselves, it's written by poets kind of telling them how amazing they are and like stroking their ego and being rewarded often with money, as I guess we were talking about that being a common means of exchange, a sort of but I suppose because it's seen as gift giving maybe sometimes rather than payment. So yeah, it is sort of interesting that it gets used in this sort of romantic context as well. And we get a few of the Icelandic sagas, we get a few kind of like love triangles as well. But I suppose in a way it's still a similar sort of idea that the men are like competing for the woman, but in, you know, this time it's about them showing off their kind of skills that, oh, I'm a great poet, not just I'm a good warrior. Sometimes they do both, you know, sometimes they have both skills. So that can be something that we see.
Yeah.
And if we sort of get to the 12th century, we have an Earl of Orkney, Earl Rognvald, who sort of goes to Jerusalem. So we're almost slightly connecting into crusading as well. But then I guess the line between Vikings and crusading, we could maybe argue, is a little bit more blurred, but you've just got religious backing this time. And he's kind of going around the south of France and sort of composing poetry for some Viscountess of Narbonne. So some people have said maybe there's a bit of like troubadour kind of courtly love influence going on, or just that it's difficult to know if there's direct influence from courtly love poetry, or just that people are just kind of detecting some slightly similar kind of threads in both, that you might often kind of direct it to a woman as your muse almost.
So Viking kings, it seems complicated and quite precarious, but it does sound like they can have a pretty good time of it if they wanted to. Was there ever any Viking queens? Was there ever a queen that ruled? A kind of a Lagertha from the TV show Vikings? Or is that just nonsense and fantasy?
Yeah, I think there might be an extent to which it's slightly wishful
thinking. I
knew
you were going to say that. I was really hoping there was going to be a Viking queen.
The experts come in and ruin everything. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's some good stories out there. I mean, we have queens who are mentioned, but in the sense of the wife of the king more. Yeah. And obviously some of them can be important or sort of be backing their sons. If their son is quite young, you know, then they'd probably have more of a role to play as well. And yeah, I suppose women could, these marriages, maybe as opposed to the concubines, could sort of be a bit more about kind of alliances, important things like that. The same Magnus Bellig that we've been talking about, when he marries a Swedish princess, her nickname is sort of like peace woman, like Frivkola. So that sort of seems to be symbolizing the kind of this union is supposed to kind of settle things down, because
no
previously
pressure then.
Yeah, a bit of a tall order maybe. Yeah. Previously Norway and Sweden have been fighting, so there's that sense of things. Yeah, I suppose maybe more in the literature we do get stories like you say, kind of Lagertha and kind of shield maidens. A lot of that is a bit later.
Is there evidence for shield maidens? Because I know that it's kind of, there is a sort of a swelling thing at the moment of like looking to the Vikings to go, they were so feminist, it was amazing. And I love that. But it's also, I don't know how true it is. Is there evidence for shield maidens?
So there was the sort of the famous burial from Birka in Sweden that had always kind of been assumed to be a male burial, because it had, you know, when it was found, it had lots of weapons. So it was kind of looked kind of like a traditional male high status warrior grave, maybe not a king, but like someone quite important and quite high up in society, at least a leader or a chieftain of some sort. But then there was the genetic testing sort of revealed that biologically it's a woman. So then we obviously, yeah, as you say, kind of got quite a lot of attention for this issue. So yeah, is she a Viking warrior woman? And yeah, it was kind of controversial in a way. And I think it is sort of interesting how some people like really want it to be true and some people really don't. And I suppose it also, yeah, maybe goes to some modern issues about, as you say, sort of feminism, or sort of thinking, yeah, women, should women be serving in the armed forces today? And maybe it can appeal to women because, yeah, you sort of want to be like kick-ass and go-getting and kind of, but then some of the representations in the media can maybe be appealing a bit more to sort of the male gaze, right? Into sort of sexual fantasies.
They weren't
and
fighting
about
in bikinis, were they? We can definitely put that one to bed.
Yeah. And then actually there have also then been a few interpretations saying that, you know, just because we have this genetic evidence, we could maybe also be thinking about kind of non-binary interpretations as well, potentially. Or, you know, that maybe she sort of was living as a man, but obviously we'll never really know the answer to all of these questions. And we do have a much later kind of legendary saga, Hera saga, or Heidrix, and this girl, she's an only child as well, so there isn't a son to inherit from the father. And she takes on quite a kind of male role and even adopts a kind of male name in the text, but kind of has to like break into the tomb and like reclaim her inheritance and reclaim her sword. So there's definitely some very interesting things going on in the sagas. But I'm sure there were some kind of warrior women, but maybe just not, you know, every other person in the army or something like that. We know maybe that with the Great Army that comes to England and the continent and then leads to all these settlements in England in particular. So we used to just assume, oh yeah, all the men are in the army and then they marry local women and sort of settle down. Some of that is definitely happening, but some recent evidence does suggest that there are some women and even children who would sort of travel with the army. So you'd assume then that these women, even if they're not kind of like a career warrior, if that makes sense, even if that's not their main role, presumably they would be able to defend themselves if necessary, or they would maybe have some training, or at least be able to handle a weapon, or at least be able to handle an axe or something that you use in other situations as well.
That makes sense. What do we know about the woman in the grave then? Because like presumably there have been tests and excavations and the archaeologists have got right in there. And there are things that we'll never know. We won't know her name. We won't know if she was a they or non-binary or any of this stuff. What do we know about the person in the grave?
I suppose the short answer is that we don't know a lot. We have the skeleton and we have the grave goods, including weapons and a horse.
Quite costly then. So like they must have been quite high status, whoever it was.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. The one thing that archaeologists always like saying is, oh, you know, the dead don't bury themselves, that like someone else buried her. So you don't even quite know what everyone would choose to be buried with and then what the people around them choose to do as well.
Yes.
But then I suppose maybe now we're being very critical of this one burial and saying, oh, well, you know, were the weapons even hers? But we maybe wouldn't be that critical if we were talking about a male burial with exactly the same objects and sort of artifacts. But yeah, as you say, she has some quite high status things. She also has like a kind of gaming board and kind of gaming pieces too. So a few things that aren't purely kind of martial, but maybe it's something that elite society would do. But yeah, sadly, we sort of don't really know that much about her, but I suppose she's just kind of come to maybe symbolise that debate as a whole. And yeah, we have a lot more examples in the literature, but then sort of how kind of legendary they are. And yeah, as you say, maybe there's the image that it would have been wonderful to be a woman in the Viking period or in medieval Scandinavia. And I think it might have been a bit better to be a woman there than in like other parts of Europe at the same time. But sort of fundamentally, it's still a kind of patriarchal society. Maybe in places like Iceland and Greenland, you might have a bit more opportunities. I suppose in frontier societies, you normally think that then people might not be as strict about gender roles, or just because the population isn't very much, you're kind of not able to be. But yeah, we do get some very, very kind of colourful, very kind of fierce women, some very kind of striking characters in the sagas, these Icelandic family sagas. We also get women who maybe aren't like committing the violence themselves, but are goading the men into doing it, are kind of really like egging them on and kind of being like, you know, like, are you really a man unless you go and take revenge for your family member who's been killed or whatever it might be. So yeah, there are some very striking moments where like they'll take like the blood-stained garment that person wore and kind of like put it around the shoulders of the person they're trying to encourage to do. So it makes them obviously seem quite kind of fierce, and because maybe in a way they only benefit from this kind of blood vengeance, whereas they can't really be in a legal setting about kind of getting compensation and kind of other avenues that you could explore. So that might be kind of one of the reasons why we get this literary trope.
The Vikings are fascinating for so many reasons, but they are one of the groups of people in history who get appropriated by different people further down the line for different reasons. The Nazis loved them because they viewed it as this proof that there was an Aryan original race, and they used a lot of runic iconography. And as you said earlier, still today, the right-wing nutheads are still appropriating their imagery for all kinds of crazy reasons. A group of people that I studied a lot is the Victorians, and I actually did my PhD on Victorians writing about the medieval period and all the mad crap that they came up with, basically. And I didn't really get into it, but I know that the Victorians were obsessed with the Vikings, and they created a lot of myth around the Vikings there as well. Is that something that you have had to confront in your research as well, what the Victorians did with the Vikings?
Yeah, I suppose to an extent that we kind of get this almost sort of rediscovery of the Vikings, that they sort of become popular again. As you say, some of that is maybe this kind of idea of this sort of common Germanicness that appealed to some parts of society. I suppose it was the Victorian era as well, where maybe people got really into the idea of the Vikings having got to America too, sort of as as America in the modern world kind of rises in importance. And I guess sort of Scandinavian immigrants to America, then obviously that kind of appealed to them that they had this old claim. You know, they beat the Italians, they beat Columbus kind of thing. And yeah, I think you can also maybe see it sort of a bit more regionally in Victorian England as well, that it starts to appeal to people in the former Danelaw area in the north and the east of England. So I think we still probably see some of it kind of, yeah, being used in sort of like regional identity and cultural heritage, that I guess as well as being popular on TV series and stuff.
Do you think we're still kind of doing that? As like a sort of a way to draw the interview to a close, to think about it, is what are we doing with this Viking myth today? Because the Viking myth, it's part of the history, but it kind of has a life of its own, the TV and the how people view it and how they appropriate it and what they project onto it. What do you think is fueling the current Viking trend? As you said earlier, they're very on trend. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that's come from? Why are we suddenly going, oh, Vikings are cool again?
Yeah, to say, I'm not sure if some of it is trying to see precursors to things in sort of modern society. Yeah, could we see them as having been a bit more feminist or a bit more, you know, inclusive of queer people or something like that? I don't know if there's maybe also a slightly like anti-authoritarian angle, maybe, or just sort of generally about this sort of like spirit of adventure and fun. Yes. But it is sort of interesting, I suppose, that they have captured the imagination more than other early medieval peoples of the same time. I guess maybe because everyone can kind of picture a Viking in their heads, whereas maybe they can't necessarily have quite the same thing for a Frank or for an Anglo-Saxon or kind of early English person, or for a Pict or a Scot or an Irish person at the same time. Even though, yeah, in reality, there's probably a lot of overlap and a lot of intermarriage between all of these groups, a lot of kind of contacts.
Okay, my final question to you, and it might not be a very fair question, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you have a favourite Viking? Of all the Vikings that you've studied, of all the bare legs and hairy breeches and blue tooths and Harald Hardrada's and all of them, do you have one that you're a bit of a sucker for, your favourite?
Yeah, because like, sometimes people will say, oh, would you want to meet one of them? And you sort of think, probably not, actually. They're probably horrible people, some of them, you know, like the reason that they're successful kings. You know, maybe you actually wouldn't want to meet them, you know, maybe that would be a bad idea. But I guess some of the kind of more ordinary people, you occasionally get a little bit of a glimpse of them. So they're sort of like runic inscriptions, you know. I guess we don't have like love letters or anything like that, right, surviving, but so amazed how in Orkney there's lots of different ones carved all over. They kind of break into this ancient mound. A couple of them are a little bit more explicit, but you get one there just saying, oh, you know, Ingigerd is the most beautiful of all women. And then in Bergen in Norway, there are runic inscriptions on sticks. There is a really funny one from Bergen where it basically says, like, she tells you to go home. And people sort of assume, you know, he's in the pub or something. And he's sort of all these rune sticks kind of found in the harbour area, maybe where, you know, there's some sailors drinking in the port. And it gets a message from the wife to say, come on. Come on, you've been out too late.
Yeah, I'd like to meet her. Yeah, you're right. She would be fabulous to meet. Oh, Caitlin, you have been fabulous to meet. You've been so much fun to talk to. And if people want to know more about you and your work, where can they find you?
Still on Twitter or X, whatever it's called, on Blue Sky as well. I think I'm known as a medievalist, a terrible pun on my part. But
I love that.
I guess on things like academia.edu and ResearchGate and places like that, or just university profile page, I guess, lists publications and things, yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. You've been marvellous.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening, and thank you so much to Caitlin for joining me. And if you like what you heard, please don't forget to like, review and follow along wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you'd like us to explore a subject, or maybe you just wanted to say hello, then you can email us at betwixt@historyhit.com. We have got episodes on everything from the history of fetish wear to scandal in the Tudor court, all marching your way. This podcast was edited and produced by Stuart Beckwith. The senior producer was Charlotte Long. Join me again, Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast by History Hit. This podcast contains music from Epidemic Sound.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Betwixt the Sheets. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code BETWIXT at checkout.